All right, I'm going to call this meeting to order. Could we, would you all please join me in the pledge of allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. All right, could we please have the roll call?
Certainly. Diane First.
Here.
Mary Beth Bushy.
Here.
Michael Horstein.
Here.
Thomas Gaffney.
Here.
Dan Hilmer.
Here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next up on...
Dean.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dean Giovanni, I'm terribly sorry. Thank you.
Yes, I want to thank Kate and Jason and CMSA for the nice new chairs. Don't they look good?
Yeah,
they're comfy.
Doesn't mean you want to come on the meetings.
Yeah, I'm going to...
Right.
All right, so we'll move on to open period for public participation. This is time set aside for any members of the public to speak during open time on anything not on the agenda. Is there anybody who would like to speak? Seeing none, we will move on to consent calendar. Matters on the consent calendar are routine, will be enacted in one motion unless anybody wants to pull anything. There are two that I think Jason and I discussed pulling. Those are H and I. Is there any member of the public, staff, or the board who would like to pull any other consent calendar items?
Chair first. On the minutes, there's three very minor edits to the minutes.
Okay.
I could.
Then why don't we go ahead and pull A?
Okay.
Okay. So, anybody want to pull anything B through G? If not, I'll entertain a motion.
So moved.
Okay. Second. Thank you. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, that passes unanimously. Let's do 4A, the minutes.
These are really minor, so I'll just run through them real quick here. So on page 407, item 11, down in the first, second, third, fourth paragraph, fourth line, it says, by assisting in operations of maintenance, the in shouldn't be there. So we're striking out the in, I-N. And then on the next page, item 12, the first sentence says DM, it should say GM. And then the last item is under the North Bay Watershed Report, item 14, page 7. The last sentence, it should say, which allows fish to navigate around an inflatable dam. The round got lost somehow. It was there at one point. And that's it.
Okay, move
to item 4A.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. I believe that was unanimous. Let's move on to 4H. Jason, you want to take this one?
Yeah, so I sent you all an email about this, but in the morning before the agenda packet being put together and published, there were many revisions based on comments between CMSA and SEIU's field representative and the SEIU attorney about revisions in the letter of understanding and also the settlement agreement. So a lot of revisions were made. And I made a mistake on the settlement agreements. We went through a few revisions. On page 2 of that, where I've highlighted, that should say 3.5%, not 4%. That's what was in the proposal. That was accepted. That was in the attendant agreement, and that's what the staff voted on. And that's what the letter of understanding.
And that's section D.
Yeah.
4D.
Yeah. So that's the only adjustment on 4H.
I'll move 4H.
Second.
Any public comment? Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That passes unanimously. 4I.
And we were just pulling 4I because we needed to have 4H approved before we approved 4I.
I move 4I. Second.
Any public comment? Seeing none? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? That passes unanimously. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Agenda item number 5, fiscal year 2016-17 audited financial statements.
So enclosed in the agenda packet is a copy of the agency's audited financial statements prepared by Siobhan and Associates, our independent auditor. It is comprised of various, you know, components. One is the auditor's report, the management discussion analysis that our staff, you know, Ken Spray prepared, the three actual financial statements, notes of the financial statements, and then supplementary information. So as you know, the audit's, you know, conducted in two phases versus the internal control audit, and that was performed in, you know, kind of later July. Then there's the final audit, which focused on the actual financials of the agency. That was in mid-September. And audit process went very well, happy to report. And here tonight is a representative from Siobhan Associates. Sheldon Siobhan wasn't able to make it, but his associate, Paul Pham, is here. You can start.
Use those arrows to scroll through.
Perfect, thank you.
You go
slideshow.
There you go. You know,
thank you very much for inviting me out here to share with you the results of the audit. So, as Jason mentioned, the audit went very well. Thank you again. So we'll start out going through just a few of the kind of summary financial statements that are part of the report. So here, the first statement that you'll see in the basic financials is the statement of net position. And so you'll see there most of the assets that you have are in your long-term assets, your capital assets, which you would expect for the nature of the business you've got. Overall, the net position decreased this year by $841,000, and so that was mainly due to some decreases in the capital assets this year. They did some minor retirements of assets that were fairly old and below the capital assets. So a little cleanup work there this year that was done. And the current liabilities, you know, not too significant there, but there was a increase there, and that was mainly due to some interest payable and compensated absences, which were classified as current. So you see those changes that were fairly significant this year. In your next statement you'll see in the basic financials is your the change in the net position. And so we'll start out with the revenues. As I mentioned earlier, with the net position, it decreased by $841,000. And a big part of that is due to the revenues. There was a big increase in the revenues of $783,000 over last year, and that was a scheduled 4% increase that you guys had planned in the service charges. And also, you'll see that there was a $100,000 increase in capital fees as well. As the increase in the debt service that was charged. So that added up to approximately $400,000 this year, this last fiscal year. And on the expenditure side, which was a significant portion of the overall change in net position, and you'll see that most of your expenditures are in the salaries and benefits. And in there, you saw a $1.9 million increase. And that was mainly due to the 4% salary increase you guys had over the previous fiscal year. So that accounted for a big chunk of the changes overall for the expenditures. And as well with the recent rollout of GASB 68, you've got the retirement, the pension portion that increased the salaries and benefits as well.
And just to clarify, that's not an actual cash expense. That's an accrued expense that they add to the statement. So our cash expense for salary and benefits didn't increase $1.9 million.
Yes, that's
just. I saw some people looking at me like, what are you guys doing?
And most of that increase was the benefits, right? It was more than the salary.
It was on the pension benefit.
Yeah.
And that's due to the GASB 68, the requirement to report on the that future liability. And then in order to do that calculation, there's got to be the offsetting expenditures that's recorded with the liability. So
how does that work when you accrue that forward? So we're not actually putting money aside physically in cash into an account, but we're recognizing the expense
that's
right
correct.
Now that we're going to pay over time in the future?
That's correct, yeah. So it's just a matching kind of deal to go with the payroll expense that's currently incurring. And so that pension liability that you have actually matches with the payroll that you currently have. So that's why there's that timing for the current year, because the expense occurred this year. So it's an accrual.
How do you show the difference? I mean, a dollar that's being paid in salary today is different from a dollar that's being accrued for future pension liability.
That's done through the actuarial. So the whole CalPERS plan has accountants and stuff doing all these actuarial studies to determine.
No, not how you calculate it. How do you show it? You're showing salaries and benefits. I think that bottom golden bar, part of it is GASB dollars. And part of it is dollars that are actually going to employees today, right?
That's correct, yeah.
How do you distinguish that in the...
Well, when we did it, prior to the adjustment, so the adjustment is done based on the calculation. So the actual account, do you guys have a separate account for the accrual part versus the actual contribution?
It's all on the same account.
It's on the same account. So yeah. We can identify just based on the journal entries that were done for the GASB 68. So if you'd like, we can provide that to show you the difference. But there is the actual expense where the actual cash was contributed to the plan, and then there's the journal entry for the accrual part of it. So we can identify it that way.
Yeah, you know, that gold bar, maybe part of it should be dotted or something so that it doesn't look like CMSA has increased its...
It's probably more appropriate, I think, to handle that in the note section.
Oh, no, okay, good idea.
Yeah, but I think it's a statement of cash flows. Does it actually show the actual salary expense and benefit expense in the statement of cash flows?
Yes, in the statement of cash flows.
And that doesn't include the accrued piece that's in this statement, right?
That's correct, yeah. So in the statement
of
cash flows...
So the next statement shows the numbers.
But the thing is, it doesn't break it out in that detail, but it does for benefits, if you're just looking at benefits overall. Yeah, and then there is some detail in the GASB 68 disclosure that does actually show the true contributions.
So you see there's cash payments to employees for services is $7.8 billion.
What page is that?
That is page 17.
And that's direct cash that's being paid, 7.8 you're talking about.
Yeah.
Right. And then on page 35, that first line of the middle disclosure there, the deferred outflows, so that first, the 957, that's the contributions that were actually made.
So do we know how this, the number on page 17, the 7867 cash payments to employees for services, do we know how that compares to the previous year? I mean, are we...
Yeah, we know that.
It didn't go up that much, right?
Yeah, like in our, you know, maybe in the... I don't think it's shown in the financial statements because you don't provide that level of detail.
Right.
But like in the agencies, like when we produce our next budget, you'll see what the actual expenses were for FY17 versus FY18.
Okay.
You'll have that comparison in salaries and in benefits.
And obviously it's going up because of the increase, but not...
So like if I recall in the budget, so we had a 4%, well, we had a, wasn't 4% salary, it was a COLA, right?
Correct. Right.
Yeah, so there was a COLA that increased compensation.
I believe it was three.
Yeah, so there was that. And then benefits, there were some changes in the benefits, but I think overall the actual benefit payments projected for this year is going to be a little less than last year, I think. So we show that in the budget, but then after this item, we'll square that up for next year, and we'll show the FY17 actuals, which will show those numbers.
Okay.
It's just a different way how you show that in a budget cash perspective versus on these financial statements.
Right. It's just hard to see that gold bar like that.
Yeah, I was surprised. Ken and I talked about that gold bar a few times.
Yeah.
Okay.
All
right.
Just as a GASB requirement.
Yeah, no, right.
And then actually, I'd like to add to that also is that GASB 68 is a brand new pronouncement. It's only been out like 2 years. And the way it works is that prior to that being implemented, the way it used to work is that if you paid all of your PERS payments, you had no liability. Now with this one, now they say you got to put the whole obligation on the books. And so if the total obligation as calculated by PERS, if that goes up, then you have to record that expense to push it up to what it needs to be. And that's this non-cash accrual that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And so that's just the way it works. But you know, if we can more clearly distinguish that to separate the two, I'm perfectly fine with that. Mm-hmm. And maybe we can describe it in the notes or in some fashion so that you know. Because mm-hmm. it's going to continue to go up, I assume, you know, with these new actuarial changes and mm-hmm. assumptions by PERS. And so it's probably not going to go down.
Yeah, the increase is going across the board. You got the employer portion, the employee portion, and even the state's putting in. So everybody's contribution rates are slowly cut.
The unfunded liability portion is just...
Right, just so they can get that down to a manageable level. And then next year, which I'll get into later, there's GASB 75 you got to look forward to, which will be a very similar thing, but that's for your OPEB plans that you guys have. So, all right, so... Capital assets, you'll see there are some changes there that I mentioned earlier, mainly due to some of the cleanup work, just to remove some of the older, you know, items that are also back then may have been above the capitalization threshold, but Ken had decided just to kind of clean up the books a little bit and not track those because they weren't necessary based on your capitalization policy, your current capitalization policy. So you'll see that there was a $1.3 million prior period adjustment related to that as well. So, all right. And then in the liabilities, the big chunk of it is from the 2015 refunding bond. And you'll see in there this year net pension liability and a little amount there with the OPEB as well. So those are the two main categories as far as your long-term liabilities. So. All right. And
so the big jump in the pension liability is because of a change in accounting procedures?
Yes, because of that recent rollout of GASB 60 a couple years back. Yeah, that is correct.
And actually, Tom, on the OPEB obligation, that's only this very small number, this $24,559, but that is going to go up to about $2.5 billion because that's the actual remaining, the total obligation that we owe. So when 75 kicks in, which I believe it's next, is it this year, 17-18?
17-18, okay. That's correct, yeah.
This so. 24,000 is going to jump to the 2.5 million.
Yeah, so you'll see a big increase just with that rollout. And that's just a disclosure thing. I mean, that liability's kind of always been there, and we've always disclosed it, but now it's going to be on the face of the financials to make it more transparent. So, one other piece I wanted to mention since we're on long-term debt, we did have a piece of the prior period adjustment related to the refunding, the advanced refunding that was done, just based on the calculation, a little correction on the calculation on the gain involved from that early retirement. So you'll see that piece in there as well, detailed out. So, and then I wanted to reference you to page 24. That's the GASB 75 that we've been talking about related to the OPEB plan. So that details what's going to happen next this coming year as far as reporting it. And the amount that Ken's referencing, you'll see on page 39. In this current year, if GASB 75 were, let's implement this year, you'd see roughly right down that schedule at the bottom there, the UAAL amount, the unfunded accrual liability, that $2.2 million there. So that will be on the face of the financials this next year.
If I can add real quick, so under GASB 45, we had to do this actuarial evaluation every few years. And what the rules were is that if you funded your annual required contribution, you didn't have to show any liability on your financial statements. GASB 75 now changes that. Regardless if you fund it or not, you have to show whatever liability you have on the financial statements. Just like you said, increased transparency.
That's right, yeah. So, like, currently on that same page, 39, all you're seeing is on that top schedule, the 24,600, that's what you're seeing on the financials now. So that's a big difference, what you'll see next year. So, okay. And, Yeah, so overall, the audit went very well. Ken and his team, they're doing a great job, maintaining the books and everything and doing all the accounting and controls that are involved. It was clean opinion, no findings, no disagreements or anything of that sort. So very good job. Any questions about anything?
Yeah, what about management controls and all? Did you review that as well?
We did. So the phase that Jason was describing earlier, we did that during our first visit. We did a two-phase audit. And so in the first phase of the audit, we did review the controls, the overall controls that you have for each of the business cycles, from disbursements to payroll, the revenue structure, that kind of stuff. So.
And another question is, GASB going to slow down? It seems like they're coming out with statements.
Oh, yeah.
Blocks,
we feel the same way, too. It's just they're constantly changing the rules on us, so it's tough keeping up.
Definitely. Well, do you think it's going to slow down?
If you look, if you want to see what's ahead, we've got.
No.
Yeah, there's quite a bit. There's quite a bit. That's always every year we disclose upcoming pronouncements. Like this, last year, again due to just full disclosure kind of stuff, be more transparent. Your cash and investments. So that rolled out GASB 72, which shows how you value your investments at fair value and. Shows the tier and the method of valuation, all that. So that was new last year. And then, like we said, 75 this coming year. So always something pretty major every year. But
are we running out of things to disclose?
Yeah, I guess so.
We keep changing how to disclose it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's what it is.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. So staff's recommendation is to accept the agency's financial statements for fiscal year ending June 30th, 2017.
Are there any other questions? Any member of the public like to speak to this? Seeing none.
I'll move the staff recommendation.
To accept the report, thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? That's unanimous.
I did note here that next year in the notes will clearly show, what's the accrued, pension liability piece of salary benefits mm-hmm. that we have to report and what's the actual cash and how things have changed. So it'll be a little clearer in next year's notes.
Gold bar isn't quite so long. Okay, moving on to agenda item number 6, the Anderson Drive Hillside Landslide Restoration.
Okay, thank you, Chair, first. So this is a kind of administrative item for the board. As we've talked about a few times in the past, due to the big, large rain events that we saw in January and February, the slope on Anderson Drive Hillside got saturated. We had, several landslides there. One was pretty significant. We have an access road from the Garbino property on our hillside, and there's, turnaround, and probably about a third of that got washed away down the hillside. So as we've talked about in the past, we hired a contractor for some emergency work to put up some K-rail along Anderson Drive, cover the landslides, put in some diversion piping so the stormwater flows can move around the landslides. And that was all done really well. And then our staff started looking into, hey, is that eligible for reimbursement through FEMA funding? So we had discussions with San Rafael Public Works, with the County of Marin, and we learned through those discussions that we had to file our own application. So we did that, and I reported on the progress of that. There's been a lot of documents we've had to sign, dozens, and the FEMA folks have had multiple phone calls with our staff, as well as visiting the agency and visiting the landslide areas, and they said these are reimbursable for the emergency work, for the design of the improvements, and for the construction of the improvements, which was great news. So what we have before the board tonight is a resolution, which is the Office of Emergency Services standard form. And by passing this, you're authorizing me to sign documents in the future associated with seeking reimbursements for that landslide and future other possible events that could occur within 3 years that were eligible for reimbursement. So the first reimbursement is going to be about $36,000 of the $37,000 for the stabilization work. So it's great news.
So instead of having jumped on this, we wouldn't have gotten it. Because there was a deadline, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was a time period that you had to file the application, and our staff was tracking all that, and they submitted all the appropriate documents, which was great news. And we learned a lot through the process, which is really valuable also.
Great.
Sorry.
Any questions or comments?
Any member of the public like to speak to this?
How's the hillside look? Because we're supposed to have an inch and a half of rain starting tomorrow.
Yeah,
well, in good shape?
It's looking good right now. Yeah. I'm hoping it's looking really good after this week.
This is pre-project, so.
Yeah, we're trying to find a contractor to cover it, and we're not having, you know, much luck because most of the contractors are tied up with all of the emergency work up in Sonoma County and Napa County. So in the near future, if we can't identify a contractor, then we'll probably dispatch, you know, our maintenance staff and me and Kate, and we'll go up there and pick up plastic and cover things up.
Yeah, wait, call on the board.
We have to use some special shoes there.
Okay. All right, I'm ready to move item 6.
I'll second.
Thank you.
Do you think the president will want to come and photo op?
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Good.
So what do we do? Have to sign some things here?
Agenda item 7, secondary clarifier corrosion repair.
Okay, so this is the presentation that I was planning to show you at the end of the last board meeting because of the time and all of that, and we've been meeting for over 3 hours. We decided to postpone it to tonight's meeting. And it was a small repair, but it was pretty significant, and we thought it was, you know, an excellent job in terms of, you know, being identified, our staff responding to it, bringing in the right people to make the repair. So this, I'll just walk through this little presentation. So, you know, we have these four primary clarifiers, settling tanks. They're about 100 feet across, maybe 15 or so feet deep. And during, you know, the wet weather season, all four are in operation. During the dry weather season, usually in the May timeframe, we bring one out of service and we do all the preventive maintenance work and corrective work. Then we put it back in service and bring another one out of service. And we rotate over the summer months doing that. And in between the clarifiers right here below ground, you have this pump room. So there's waste-activated sludge pumps, return-activated sludge pumps, sump pumps, and lots of piping. And in each of these corners right here, there's piping that removes the material from the clarifier. So there's a drain pipe, so you want to drain the tank. There's all of the wasting, you know, piping, so that removes the sludge that you don't want to recycle and you send it to the digesters. Then there's the recycled piping, so that's the sludge that you want to recycle back to the aeration tanks. So all that piping leaves the clarifier and enters this pump room, and it leaves a wall, and then it goes in the floor, and it comes up out of the floor. And where it comes out of the wall and enters the floor, there is a like a little sump, a little pit. So it's about maybe this wide and maybe this long. And, you know, these pipes coming out and then these big, you know, expansion fittings. So that they're different concrete pores, so things move relative to each other. You know, this expansion fitting could absorb that. And they're underneath grading. And, you know, it's pretty rare that we go and take a look at those expansion joints. Happens, you know, once in a while. So during the facility's master plan work, Corolla engineers, you know, they had some staff, you know, discipline-specific engineers that walked the plant over a couple days, and they're just doing a visual condition assessment. So they were down here doing the assessment, and they said, well, let's take a look at those expansion joints in those four corner sumps. So they went to the sump on clarifier number 3 here, pulled the grating, and the piping looked pretty bad. And they said, well, you guys need to have that looked at a lot closer by a corrosion engineer and another expert as appropriate. So we noted that, made it a high priority. So then they finished their work, and then moving forward, we received this technical memorandum, number 1, a draft version of it for the condition assessment, and there was a big project for secondary clarifier, you know, repairs and activities, and then one aspect of that big project was replacing the piping in these four sumps, and that had a cost of, well, I mean, it was like, you know, probably was like $1.6 million overall. Was $530,000 for the four sumps. So one sump would have been $135,000 to do the work. So that was in the draft report. So then what we did is we hired, well, I'll go through the slides now. I'll just keep talking. We'll see some things. So this is what was underneath the grating in that little sump area. So you see here's the pipe coming out of the wall, the expansion fittings. So it looks pretty bad. This is a close-up of one of the pipe sections, and this is where there wasn't any steel left on the pipe. That's just the internal, you know, mortar coating. So that's pretty bad, because you're holding back all of that, you know, head for that secondary clarifier. So what we did is we, after seeing that, we had, you know, V&A consulting engineers come in. They did, you know, an assessment of each of those pipe sections in those four sumps, and they said the other three pipe sections were in sound condition. Wall thickness was fine. Here's just this one sump that there was a problem. And they said, okay, you probably need to bring in, you know, a design engineer or some other experts to figure out how you're going to, you know, replace or rehabilitate these pipes. So our staff contacted a general contractor, Pacific Infrastructure, and they've done several agency projects in the past, the most recent being the hypochlorite room rehabilitation project, which Commissioners Gaffney and First toured one day. And their superintendent came out at the end of 1 week. He looked at it and said, oh, yeah, we can make those repairs. We talked about the, kind of the general scope. Over the weekend, they prepared a detailed scope of work with all the sequence of activities, a cost estimate, submitted it, and it was $33,000. So we thought, well, that's great. And their approach to doing the project made a lot of sense to us, so we contracted with them, hired them. They ordered the materials, and they a few weeks later, they started the work. So these are the pipe sections cut out. So you see how thin the steel is here. And you can see in here, that's the actual thickness of the pipe that runs through the concrete floor of the clarifier. And the repair was to cut all the old stuff out and break out the concrete around the pipe until you found, you know, sound wall thickness of pipe. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, it was only, you know, was that a couple inches maybe?
Yeah, it was just a few inches into the wall.
We were kind of concerned, would have had to go back, you know, a long ways. It was just a couple inches, so they found, you know, sound wall of pipe. Here's the materials they ordered, you know, new expansion joints, you know, flange pieces to weld to the good pipe they found. Here's the little corner sump, and they're starting their work in there. So they welded the flanges to the sections of the pipe in the wall behind the broken out concrete. Here's the flanges being welded on to the drain line and the RAS line, I think. Then they hand applied new mortar inside the pipe. And here it is, you know, all installed with new expansion joints and seismic restraints. And then they put a protective coating over the concrete and the metal. And here's kind of, you know, how the project played out. And the total cost was their $33,000 plus the V&A corrosion engineer, you know, on-site costs. And no changes. So that was a small project, but, you know, really, really important. We're glad that Corolla engineers pulled the grating off that sump and looked at it. Yeah.
Why did only one spore go? And why did it deteriorate so badly?
You know, we don't have a good answer to that, but it's likely there was probably some flaw in the coating material of the pipe. Maybe if, you know, a flaw or a pinhole in the mortar lining, then just being, you know, in that environment with activated sludge, you know, in there for most of the year, and that material made its way through these pinholes and just corrosion started. And that started up back in 1985. So just over, you know, the years since then, you just had continued, you know, just, you know, corrosion of the steel.
Do we know where we got that on the pipe?
We could, you know, we could go back and look at the shop drawings that the general contractor submitted back in 1980.
I'm just curious about that. When pipeline deteriorates like that, something's wrong, and we would probably want to go and look and see where else in the plant are pipe of that same vintage.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, there's the other three sumps are of that vintage. So
they're good.
But those are good.
Just a one-off? And
well, it was a one-off just for this area. But what we learned, you know, from this is that we need to have a program now where we go, kind of like what you suggested, go out and take a close look at these, you know, pipe sections that leave walls. And the condition, especially ones that are below ground or in sumps. And there's a few places like that. We do have in our capital plan some investigations of some of the major pipelines between process tanks, such as between the primary clarifiers and the biotower. There's some pretty big pipe sections, steel pipe sections below ground. So at some point, you know, we'll be, you know, probably sending a diver in there to take a look, or we'll even be doing open cut and taking a look at those pipes.
So the corrosion consultant had no opinion on that, huh?
No, I mean, he just, you know, Brian, did they say anything beyond what we kind of talked about in terms of pinhole failures and mortar lining?
Yeah, they had no, nothing was obvious to them that was a cause for the failure.
Okay.
I mean, weird.
You've got a huge percentage of your pipeline that was put in the 80s, right? Isn't there a lot? So,
almost everything was installed in the 80s, yeah.
And one of the things I was going to talk about during depreciation was you were telling us that some assets in the plant are depreciated down to zero, but still have a useful life.
That's right, that's right.
And maybe we redo the life on some of these. They're exceeding the life.
Yeah, that was one thing that we talked about, is that, you know, when we first set up, you know, the accounting system and the fixed asset schedule for the agency, everything was entered in, and everything had a certain service life. And you start straight line depreciating, you know, over whatever the years are. But we have a pretty proactive, you know, maintenance program, so things are well maintained. So you may have a pumping system that originally had a 5-year lifespan, so it's fully depreciated, but it's in good condition because of the proactive maintenance, and it still maybe has 10 more years of life associated with it. So I talked with the auditors, you know, last year, and I said, what can we do to extend the service lives of some of these assets we already have that maybe have very little life left, book life left from an accounting perspective? And he said, all you need to do is you have to justify it, and then your board has to pass a policy associated with that. Then you change the service lives for the audit, and then your depreciation changes in the fixed asset schedule.
Right, and you can start booking more to capital maintenance too when you're really thinking along those lines. So it can be a complicated. Once you start messing with the service lives, though, there's a lot of a lot of dominoes start falling.
Yeah.
And the advantage is, you know, it's an accounting thing, but you're using the facilities and we're getting the advantage. We don't need to worry about the depreciation.
So there's kind of like the accounting perspective, and then there's the actual condition that we base our repairs and maintenance on, and capital replacement. Those are separate.
Right, and an even a bigger separate pile is rate making. The plant's not one day going to our rates aren't going to go to zero when the plant is fully depreciated. You know, so
that's right.
Yes.
That's right.
Yeah.
That would not be good for us.
That would not be good idea. we need that capital. Yeah.
So when I was reading the financial report, that your statement of net position then, we're actually looking better than what's currently being shown then?
Going forward, say we did the analysis, I'd probably bring an expert to help us figure out how to do it. He'd come to the board, say you guys adopted something, we changed the service life of things going forward in existing assets. Then in the next financial statements, the depreciation would be less than in the current.
Right. But even like just taking today's and knowing, like, I noticed you, this building here has a 40-year life on it, but it's in very good condition.
Yeah, and we've remodeled it. We've done a lot of roof repairs on it. It'll be around for quite a while longer.
And it was built when?
85.
Okay, so we have like 10 years left on that, and I know there's
probably 8 years left. Yeah,
and it will go a lot longer than that. So
we'd change. So we'd add maybe, like, say the boards for the admin building, we add 20 more years of service life to it, and the depreciation slows down.
Or on the flip side, usually everything, but you know, as a gut check reality, that we're looking a lot better with our assets than are shown on the books.
Oh yeah, and we know that we've always since I've got the job, you know, we're looking at all this depreciation each year, and, you know, our net position decreasing over time. It's, you know, it's frustrating how the accounting works. It doesn't want, because we do such a good job at planning out capital work and, you know, maintaining systems, it's just frustrating to see what you report in the financial statements and how the total assets of the agency is only $48 million. But, you know, if you were to replace everything here, it would be hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars.
Right.
Yeah, we got that estimate. It was $310 million, right? From that Corolla report, replace everything.
I think that was just for building new clarifier, wasn't it? You mean for the?
Yeah, I remember the clarifier went from 11. The projects went from like 11.4 to 310 million.
Oh, that was the no feasible alternative blending analysis.
Yeah.
So that was building 85 MG more secondary clarifier system, aeration system. Yeah. But it'd be more than that if we had to replace everything.
We shouldn't do that.
No. All right. Anybody from the public want to comment on this? Mm-hmm. Seeing none. Any other thoughts? This is
project.
Informational only.
Thank you.
Yeah, good job getting it down to 34,000. Moving on to agenda item 8, construction progress update for the maintenance facility modifications project.
Thank you. So back in March, the board awarded the construction contract for the maintenance facilities modification project to Bueller Construction. That was about $1,015,000. And shortly after that, they started their on-site work. The work has progressed very well. They have a great working relationship, you know, with the agencies, you know, construction management team. And we're targeting that the project will be kind of wrapped up by early December, so it's likely on the December agenda. We'll have an item in the consent calendar for the board to accept the project as complete and authorize us to send the notice of completion to the County of Marin. And normally when we have these type of, you know, remodel projects, we like to, you know, invite the board to come in and take a tour of the facilities. But since it's dark at 5 o'clock now, we're not going to be able to do that until the springtime. So in talking with Amy and Brian, we thought it would be a good idea just to show you what the improvements were. So with that, I'd like to introduce you to Amy Wang, our assistant engineer, who was the key agency, you know, representative on the construction phase of the project, and she was also actively involved in the design phase of the project, and she's done wonderful work for us, and she prepared this nice staff report and the presentation.
Hi, good evening. My name is Amy Huang, and I'll be giving the construction progress update for the maintenance facility modifications project. Before I move on to the next slide, this project really had three major components. First was the construction of a new storage shed. Then I'm going to move on to talking about renovations done to the maintenance building. And lastly, I'll talk about grading improvements between this building and the maintenance building. So first, to describe the new storage shed construction, the storage shed was built over in the maintenance annex area, which is over at the eastern end of this plant, and it was constructed right next to this final effluent vault here, which you can see better in this slide. So this is a final effluent vault, and this is where the new storage shed will be placed. So the contractor, Bueller Commercial, first started by clearing the area of vegetation, all of the gravel that used to be there, and leveled it off in preparation for the new storage shed placement. And one of the first things they did was to provide a new 4-inch fire main going to the storage shed, as well as fire sprinkler systems. So here you can see the alignment going back to the storage shed here. And they made the connection by this existing main feeding the maintenance annex building here.
Cost more than the shed.
So I'm going to run that pipe out there.
And you can see here, so they began excavating around this area, and it was interesting to see because it just happened to be where all of these utility lines were located. And we weren't really sure exactly where they were. We just knew it was around that area. But it was actually a good opportunity because while they were excavating and tying in the new 4-inch line, we took the opportunity to mark the exact locations, figured out which lines were what, and you can see the final product here. So this is the new 4-inch line going to the shed, and that's the existing line. So they did break a couple pipes in the process, but that really helped us find out which lines were which, and they were fixed really fast. So no problems there.
Really fast.
Yeah.
What were those? Oh. What was that? Water,
yes.
Or?
Yeah, so this is the existing line, and some of these were the dechlorinated final effluent going back to the head of the plant. Some of these were conduits. Some of them were sump pump lines from the maintenance annex building. Mm-hmm. And one of them is the water line. Yeah, so a lot of lines.
So why do you have dechlorinated effluent heading back to the beginning?
That is our bioassay line.
Okay.
Yeah. We have a 96-hour test that we have to perform each month under our NPS permit, and we have some equipment for the test. So we have to bring dechlorinated final effluent back to our laboratory. then we have a test apparatus where it's different tanks and we have different fish in there and they have to live for 96 hours in the final effluent.
Got it. Thank you.
Is there like little signs you should put on those while you're in there for next time?
Little labels?
Yeah, when they actually buried this new line, they put in a new tracer wire as well as a tape saying that there's a pipe underneath that's a new standard now. So,
or just take Sharpie and like write on those pipes.
Don't get
tracer wire is a little more high tech.
If you can read this, you're too close.
Or it's too late. Yeah. Okay. So this next slide is a picture of them pouring the foundation slab. So the foundation slab is the supporting slab for the storage shed. So the storage shed is going to sit on top of this. It's 16 inches thick. And then there was also the approach slab that's 6 inches thick. I believe that's where our maintenance staff is going to park like the big heavy equipment like the telehandler. So both of them were poured separate floors.
Did you need to put piles in there?
No.
Is this not settled?
Yeah, there's a lot of rock under this area, and they overexcavated, you know, quite. How many feet did they overexcavate?
They overexcavated by 6 inches, or almost a foot.
Yeah, almost a foot.
Yeah. And so, in order to kind of mitigate that problem, they did a lot of compaction tests. So they compacted up to 95-96%, especially in the foundation area, because we didn't want it settling over time.
During the design phase, we had some soil borings done back there to ensure that a mat slab like this would actually work.
Yeah. Okay, so then after that was done, the prefabricated metal building parts arrived on site, and it was really cool to see them actually assemble it because it only took them 2 weeks to put this whole thing together. Assembling the framing here actually only took them 2 to 3 days, and the rest of the time they used to put up the wall panels, the roof panels, gutters, and downspouts. And so all of that done in 2 weeks, and then they came back to install new lighting, fire sprinkler lines, and that was it. So it's about 1,000 square feet in area, and it's just going to be used for storage. Okay. Then the second portion of the project is the maintenance building renovation. So before I delve deeper, so this is the admin building and this is the maintenance building. We're located right here. And this area in yellow is the zoomed in version of this. It's just a building, but this view shows the pre-construction and this shows the final constructed with the modifications. And the renovations really took place in two ends of the maintenance building, the shop side and then the office side. On the shop side, this area actually used to be all open, and the renovations really included enclosing this area, so you can see new walls were placed here, and converting the two restrooms into a single accessible restroom, and converting the rest of that area into a janitor's closet. And we have two separate storage mezzanine levels. And on the office side, the contractor removed all of these internal walls and put in a new wall that's a little further back so we can have more room for maintenance and technical services staff. And then put in a new set of stairs leading upstairs to the mechanics office area, which I can talk about more later. So I'm going to start with the shop side first. So this is the shop side, except taken from the outside, and here is that exterior area that's open, that used to be open. And they began by putting up new framing and installing plywood sheathing, so now it's all enclosed, and they got a stucco subcontractor to come out and match the existing stucco. And you can see you can't really see here, but it's a really good match in terms of the roughness and the color, and new doors placed here, so. This is still the shop side, but these pictures were taken from the inside. So here's the newly framed external walls with the mezzanine storage floor. And here it is after it's all been insulated. And the bottom two pictures are the finished products. Here are the two storage mezzanine areas. You can't see the other one, but they're accessible by these alternating tread stairs. I don't know if any of you guys have used them. It was my first time seeing them. It's really disconcerting going up, but they work because they save a lot of space. And so it's interesting. So now moving on to the office side, this is what it used to look like. So like I said, they tore all these walls down, put up new walls here. This is the door opening here. And then these are the newly framed stairs leading upstairs to the mechanics area. So you can see a better picture of it after all the furniture has been installed. So this is the upstairs mechanics office. It currently has about 7 workstations, and then here is one of the 3 private offices for the supervisors, and down here is that open office area with 7 workstations for maintenance staff and technical services staff. So it looks really nice in there now. Okay, and the final portion is the grading improvements between the admin and the maintenance buildings. So due to settlement over time, this sloped area, so this is the before picture, this sloped area really had a pretty drastic slope, greater than 5%. So to meet ADA accessibility standards, Bueller Commercial removed all of these concrete squares and replaced them with, regraded it, repaved it, and this is the new final picture of what it looks like now. And slopes are no greater than 5% and even 2% in some areas. So this one, I took this picture facing the admin building, which is right here. And the ramp portion actually begins from this portion here. So here's the ramp leading up to the maintenance building. And 2 new sets of stairs were placed, one here. And the other one's actually located back here. I just didn't get a good picture this day because they weren't placed yet. I was trying to frantically get these new pictures in before the agenda went up. So I took this picture right after they poured the concrete here. So this is the continuation of the ramp leading up to the maintenance building door here. So this is what it used to look like with the drastic slopes, and now there's a nice ramp leading up to it.
Because, you know, like we talked about before, all of the floors of the agency, everything's supported by piles, and everything's at the same elevation when in 1985. Between, you know, the pond and the maintenance building and the admin building, that's over very thick layers of bay mud, up to 100 feet in some places. And over, you know, the 30 years, those bay muds have consolidated to where that slope right there didn't look too big. But if you were standing where the van was, it was pretty steep. And we had a program where every several years we would go in and we'd cut some of that, you know, asphalt out at the building because a big lip would form, a trip hazard. Mm-hmm. And then cut out by the white line there in front of the van and put new asphalt in just to build a nice slope up. Mm-hmm. When I first started here, it was like, you know, slope like this. Now it was like that. So this was nice because you cut out the slope and you put in the nice, you know, accessible, you know, sidewalk going up, ramp.
Yeah, you can roll carts and things around.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
You can invite Richard Scaff over.
No,
we don't want to do that.
Great job with that. Lots of concrete poured.
That's good.
It was a lot of concrete. More than I ever thought in my life. Okay, so that was it.
Okay. Okay. Nice detail.
Thanks, Amy.
I actually have one little question, though. The storage shed on the back, is that insulated?
That is not.
Okay.
Because, yeah, you could see the roll-up doors, they were open, and there's a little side door, but none of it was insulated.
And we don't need that insulated that we're okay with?
In storage yet?
Yeah.
Yeah, because we're just going to have, I mean, large pumps and, you know, big bulky type of materials in there and things that aren't affected really by the elements. What we may do at some point, I think Amy mentioned in one of the slides, is we put, you know, roll-up doors on the 2 main access door, you know, openings into the shed. But definitely doesn't need to be insulated. There won't be people in there.
Okay.
Except just getting materials and supplies.
Got it. Okay. Any other questions?
Only a comment. I'm very impressed at the there's some big elements in there that require a lot of coordination. And so it's more than a shed. I mean, it's a big, big ass project. Excuse me.
Our staff did a great job. From it all started with the maintenance staff having to move everything out of the existing maintenance building. And they found all kinds of neat stuff in there that had been there reconstruction even, you know. So they purged a lot of materials and they moved things all around the plant to free up all the space. And then our staff did a great job on the design and being really considerate on the different design elements and got a lot of staff involved in, you know, the furniture layout. And Kate was involved in selecting the furniture right and the colors of chairs and things. And so it all looks nice in there. And Amy did a great job, and Brian, and we had a CM support staff person, Isaac D, who some of you probably remember. He started back here in 1981 working for Harrison Associates for CM work and stuff. And he's under contract. Every once in a while he comes in, he provides, you know, CM support for us. And he worked with Amy on all the construction work. So it was a great learning experience for Amy also on the actual physical inspection work out in the field. So it was great work by all the staff and our consultants on the project.
Thank you.
Anything else?
It's great to see a project that you've designed actually get built, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great seeing it from the beginning to the end.
Yeah. And on time and pretty close to on budget. So.
Yeah.
Very well done, Amy.
Good project.
And thank you for coming to give the presentation. Anything else?
No, that's great.
Okay. Moving on.
Not often you see a 16-inch thick mat on leash.
Do we need to officially accept the report?
No, it's just information.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Amy.
Thank you. Agenda item 9, rescheduling the December 2017 board meeting.
So we're just interested in rescheduling that meeting, and we contact all the board members, and it looks like everybody's available the next day, Wednesday.
We need an action.
Yeah, we need action. I'll move that. Do we want to select a time? It could be at 7. It could be any time that is good for the board.
Yeah, is anybody interested in upping the meeting?
Earlier?
Mary Beth, is it a problem for you to get here earlier?
It is. I need to come from the city, so.
7 o'clock is a good time?
7 o'clock is a good time.
Okay.
I think we're doing
7 o'clock.
But I will mention, and I'm jumping ahead just a little bit, that is the same day as the holiday lunch.
That's right. We have a holiday potluck that day, which is in my oral report handout here, and you're all invited to that. So it's the same day.
Okay. And so that's not too much to have both in one day?
No.
Can you have a drink in the afternoon and just stay?
I'm not your bike home.
No, I can't do that.
Okay, so Dan, was that a motion to?
It's so moved.
So I'm putting it in my calendar. So
anybody want a second?
Second.
Thank you. Any member of the public like to speak to this? Seeing none. All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you.
Thank you. So that'll be a special meeting. So we'll be setting up the agenda about a day in advance, and we'll email it to all of you also. So we'll probably email and probably hand deliver it also on the Tuesday.
Okay. I would like to. First of all, moving on to agenda item number 10, North Bay Watershed Association report. I was unable to attend the meeting. I came down with a little virus or something. So Michael is going to finally give the report.
So there's a lot of stuff at this meeting. They gave a talk about, obviously, the fire and some of the concerns of what's happening with that. It's going to be a big problem when the rebuilding actually begins to occur, because they're figuring on the average dollars per square foot are going to be the $300 to $400 per square foot, and most people don't have replacement cost in their insurance, and it looks like the insurance companies are going to pay approximately $216 a square foot. People aren't probably going to be a lot of the older community that's not probably going to either want or be able to stay because they're not going to be able to rebuild like they used to. As far as the watershed goes, they were talking about this, that a lot of the stormwater pipes below the ground are plastic, and they melt it. Lots of miles of stormwater drains that don't exist anymore. And in fact, they're expecting a big storm up there, and the people in Fountain Grove and who are left at Coffee Park, which is not many, are being instructed, get ready, because we may evacuate at a second moment's notice, because even in the last little rain, they had some sinkholes up there. So, it's interesting.
Do you know what kind of plastic the pipes are made of?
I don't. I don't remember.
It's totally biodegradable, I'm sure.
It's not.
Is that probably the same material that every other jurisdiction uses in storm drains?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what's, you know, if there's a standard by jurisdiction. I always got storm drain pipes with, like, you know, like corrugated metal pipes, things. Do you know what's...
A lot of it's concrete.
Concrete.
A lot of it's concrete, but for some reason... Okay.
I'm surprised to hear plastic.
No, the enclosed systems on most homes are perforated plastic.
On homes, so you're not talking about in the streets or
main. I think the all the problem
in the streets. Yeah. They were talking about the plastic melting with the severe temperatures of the fire.
Right. So it's probably like the shallow ones on the property.
In the streets,
where you kept. I saw it on the news. It was more than the.
Wow.
Goes into the catch basins and then what's carting it away down to wherever it collects and dumps into a creek and stuff.
It might be a similar material that we
just
use
thicker walls.
In
water
sewers. You know.
The sewer is a plastic material.
Yeah.
Yeah, newer sewer pipes.
Water lines are too.
Yeah.
I'm surprised storm drain, I always think of as a...
Maybe the sewers were deeper. The sewer lines, because the storm water, you'd be hooking up to all the gutters, right?
Yeah,
the enclosed systems on the properties would mostly be plastic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So anyway, it was interesting, because they had a lot of first-hand experience of the people up there who got burnt down, talking about it. They talked about... The weather systems that we have locally are very old. They're very old technology. And the storm radars tend to point pretty much straight up to see what's going on. And so they're moving to new technologies all around, for instance, these atmospheric rivers that catch us by surprise. Or because our current storm radars aren't seeing them come in. By the way, that's what's supposed to hit tomorrow. And they actually have one of these new radar facilities that looks further out over the ocean at Santa Clara sewer treatment down there. They have a piece of their property, and it's on top of a building somewhere. Anyway, and they're working to... believe it or not, even in this time of interconnection, the radar facilities that do exist are not interconnected with NOAA so that they can all talk to each other and garner more consolidated information so that the left hand can know what the right hand is doing. But they're working very hard to do that currently. Then there was a fellow who came, James Mueller, of the San Francisco Estuary Partnership, and believe it or not, Ben Bodkin from ABAG, have been working on a project, and this is for the facility here, you put it out there.
Okay.
A set of maps. It's the Bay Area Water Trail. And it's really quite amazing. It's one for each piece of the bay. So like we'd be the North San Pablo Bay. And it's really for boaters and small watercraft. Mm. To to have a map of, okay, birds are going to be rafting here, and when are they doing it? So don't go on your windsail stuff in there, and don't bring your boat in there. And you might have sea lions over here with pups, and where are they doing that? And they really did quite an amazing. It's worth a peek at this. It's meant for people with watercraft, but I just thought it was really interesting. And it's all then going to be interconnected with the Bay Area walking trail and bike riding trail, and it's going to be a really fun place to be when this is all done.
Do you happen to know if those are online?
Yeah, they are. And okay. You can sfbaywatertrail.org.
Thanks.
Yes, sfbaywatertrail.org. And they were pretty cool. They were very passionate. They sort of did this on a shoestring budget, and they're going around to all sorts of city open house kinds of things and educating the people in that area what's going on. Also, and I'll just add in, other than the North Bay Watershed, there's another group that meets once a month here called Marin Coalition. And they meet the first Wednesday of every month up at McGinnis Park. And sometimes they have really amazing people come and talk. And just real quick, the last meeting they had a woman, I can't remember her name, I apologize, who's a professor of climate geology at UC Berkeley. She's written several books. And their job is to go back and study climates in the past by looking at what's going on from core samples. It's like, for instance, I did not know that in 1861 in California, there was a massive rain event that happened, and the entire Central Valley from one end to the other was under 20 feet of water. Sacramento was under 8 feet of water. Temporarily, they had to move the capital of the state to San Francisco. And it took so long to drain through the Delta when that happened that San Francisco effectively turned into a freshwater lake. They know that because they do core samples here, and they could go down and they could see the reeds.
Yeah,
the reeds that were growing in that strata were freshwater reeds. So they know what the salinity was by studying the diatoms. They're absolutely fascinating. And what's interesting, and maybe to be noted here, is that throughout history, every 150 to 200 years, for as far back as they've core sampled, we've had a rain event like that. That has, and they can see from the bay, those stratas that have done that. And so if you do the calculation, 1861 was 150 years ago, and so sometime in the next 50 years, historically, we're going to see a rain event like that happen again in Modesto and Fresno and Merced and Tracy, and all those could conceivably be under 20 feet of water. Somebody brought up, well, what does that mean for that new high-speed train they're building? It better be a high-speed submarine. Did anybody think of that? Anyway, it was a very...
Well, it's
very
east of there where he's 20 feet of water. That would be
But anyway, it was interesting that throughout history, these climate events have occurred. And a lot of the people here in Marin County wanted her to get all upset. You know, what can we do, to call our congressman, whatever. So that's not what I'm here about. I agree that everybody needs to stay back. But even if we knocked off all of our carbon emissions that are man-made, tomorrow, it would take 200 years to absorb all that carbon dioxide back into the ocean. So it's going to be an issue for long after any of us are around. Anyway, both organizations are incredible.
Okay, thank
Great.
You.
I'm not going to be able to sleep tonight.
Can you lighten things up a little bit, Jason, now with your... Well, I should ask. Oral reports by commissioners. Anybody have anything?
No. I can't take any more.
No. Jason, it's on you.
Yeah.
Cheers.
It's only Jason.
So the most important thing on here is the good time you all have on December 13th, the Holly
Highlighted.
So if you can come in here, that'd be great. We always have a nice event at the agency. JP review process, that's going very well with ad hoc committee. Our next meeting is a typo here that I put in. It's actually on November 30th. So far, they've reviewed and revised 15 of the 26 JPA sections, and I think all NC boards have accepted those. And so on the 30th, we'll be reviewing the next to last grouping of items. So that's been going forward very well. MPS permit status. So the permit adoption hearing is currently scheduled for December 13th. But I just heard today from our regulatory consultant who talked with the staff at the water board that it's possibly that that'll be moved to January 10th board meeting, regional water board meeting. Then under CMSA business, so 10 members.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So it is moving forward with co-permittees under each of our agencies?
That's what's in the tentative order. And comment letters went in. San Rafael and Ross Valley had a common comment letter, which was very comprehensive. A lot of proposed language in there to modify certain provisions within, you know, the tentative order to minimize, you know, third-party loss of liabilities and similar type of activities that could happen under a federal permit. But we'll have to wait to the final order to see what happens. And I'm not quite sure when the final order is going to come out. But, you know, from talking with Monica, our regulatory consultant, she doesn't think that the Regional Water Board is going to, you know, remove the member agencies as co-permittees. And hopefully they'll accept some of the comments from the members to alleviate some of their concerns of being listed in the permit. But we're not going to know until either they provide comments, you know, response letters, which, you know, I heard may be coming out pretty soon, or we receive the final order, which then gets, you know, presented to the Regional Water Board itself. That's all the information I have on it. From just a CMSA, you know, treatment agency perspective, the permit is very good. Then under CMSA business, so 10 members of the grand jury toured the, I gave them the Marin County Wastewater Agency presentation. They really appreciated that, and we spent about an hour and a half out of the facilities. Then a few days later, they asked me to come and actually meet with, you know, the full special committee, special district subcommittee of the grand jury. So I went up and met with them, and they had a lot of questions and stuff. I had to sign some forms saying that I can't talk about anything that they told me or I said to them in the room.
Grand jury.
Then finance committee's meeting on the 21st, and we just set up an ad hoc energy committee meeting for right after that finance committee meeting on the 21st. And then here's an update on some of the bills that were enacted by the governor that Castle was tracking on. And that's my report.
You didn't share us that much, especially with this last attachment in your informational items about AB 967. Is that the bio cremation facilities?
Yeah.
Do we need to worry about that at all?
Well, if one was, like, say, City of San Rafael permitted one, and they actually wanted, if that organization wanted to discharge those liquid hydrolyzed remains to the sanitary sewer system, they'd have to receive approval from San Rafael Sanitation District and also from CMSA.
Can that be part of the FOG?
Yeah.
It'd be a separate program.
It's just going recent.
It ends up in your digester, right?
In person.
I mean, eventually.
Yeah, and actually in the legislation, the original legislation was that they could, you know, do the biocremation, and they would take, you know, the liquid remains to a facility that had an anaerobic digester.
Right.
Or a bioenergy type facility to convert those liquid remains to energy. But then there was, you know, some lobbying by other groups, and they wanted, you know, the ability to discharge it into the sewer system. Mm-hmm. It turns out there's like, I think it was like 13 states that allow this. And in those 13 states, they do allow it being discharged directly to the sewer system with approval of, you know, the local, you know, wastewater agency.
And what is the consistency? Is it like almost like a powder?
It's liquid,
but if you were to dry out the liquid, would it be almost just a really fine powder?
You know, we've never talked about that at the legislative committee.
We're not talking about bones coming through and stuff like that, are we?
I think it's all completely hydrolyzed, so it's all liquefied.
All liquefied.
So it's not like, you know, when it's cremated and there's still kind of fragments and it's dust and stuff. It's all just liquid material.
So is it alkaline or acidic?
I don't know.
Anyway, I would worry about the pipes, but I'll leave that to San Rafael.
Yeah, they'd have to go through our whole, you know, pre-treatment, you know, authorization
but
process.
But it sounds like they have the right to truck in this substance to the digester, right?
And they'd have to get permitted to do that, and we'd have to accept it.
So we
And then we have to come to the board and set a tipping fee for that.
Right.
Okay.
So when I read this, I go, man, it sounds really creepy, but if it's a law and it's allowed, so is it just more of a public perception thing that we would have to just deal with that with our ratepayers and the people we represent that we're taking in remains at our sewer plant? Is that what it is, really? Just a perception thing versus a treatment issue?
I don't think it would be a treatment issue, because it means really it's just kind of, you hate to say it, it's another organic type of liquid that comes in, right?
Right.
Unless it was terribly acid or terribly alkaline, and then I actually can't worry about it.
Exactly, yeah.
So
we would, you know, part, if we were to consider this, this would be something I bring to the board and we could talk about it.
Great.
Yeah, but we'd have, if you guys said, yeah, let's look at permitting these folks and set a tipping fee, we'd make sure that it was a neutral pH or it was something that was, you know, relatively neutral.
You'd have to have a whole lot of bodies for it to make any kind of a difference.
I mean, not in the local sewer, though.
Just putting it down the drain. Trucking it in.
I mean, what's the difference between
but
that
that's
and
a, like, I don't know, they come in a hearse?
That's what I mean. It's a perception.
It's a perception.
It's just total perception.
Thanksgiving. Yeah. How much
that's all you're going to have to fare out.
I prefer a celebration of
life. A celebration of life.
That's really what it's about.
Okay, Tom, you had a question?
Yeah, you know, the legislation here that CASA has supported that's going to impact us the most by far is SB 231. And what it does is it remembers Prop 218 excludes water, sewer, and solid waste from the requirements of a two-thirds vote.
That's
so
right.
If this adds stormwater to that, it means we're going to get stormwater service charges. That's really what that means. Now, I was trying to do that for years and going up to the regional board and saying, for crying out loud, you guys are right down the hall from each other, the stormwater guys with their NPDES permits or whatever it is. You know, so that is going to be, we're going to have sewer, we're going to have stormwater service charges.
Does that mean you're going to have a stormwater treatment permit?
They have discharge permits for certain.
It's not going to affect CMC's business, really.
Intentionally. We don't intentionally have it.
No. Some
gets in here.
That's a whole other story.
It'll be cities that have stormwater.
I know, but what if they have more strict treatment
requirements? They are
going to
have.
I think this isn't a two-thirds vote. This is a protest hearing. For stormwater now, right?
Exactly. It doesn't require
a two-thirds
vote. It does the 218 mailer like we do.
It allows you to charge stormwater
fees.
Exactly.
But that's not us. It's not CMSA, but it is City of San Rafael and Larkspur.
It's the districts.
And Wayne County. Figure out how we're going to charge for it.
If there's nothing else, we will adjourn.
Thanks
for
making
the day. Thank you all. Good night. If there's Soylent Green, who knows what movie Soylent Green is?
Watch that.
What movie was that?